literally no effort, you know. Just sat there going, just trying to squeeze beard out.
Yeah, it took me 2 weeks.
Yeah. Well, I shaved this morning.
Some people have that, but not me.
Yeah, I used to share a house with a guy at uni. He was, he would shave in the morning, and by lunchtime, he'd have stubble.
Mm. Yeah, my dad really is like that. And he was always laughing at me because till I was 30, I couldn't even grow one hair.
I used to joke, I had a colleague in work who, we were always sort of joking that he'd done the Movember, but the year before, and he was still trying to grow out to where he was, you know, kind of at a year later. It's kind of four random hairs somewhere vaguely near his chin. That's about as much as he could manage.
It's next sick month. Are you trying? Stuff, are you planning to chop your beard, Jamie? Maybe.
No, I've toyed with it in the past, and it's just, it's part of me. And I think if I cut it all off now, I'd probably get kicked out my job, and I know I'd be kicked out my home. So.
Yeah, I remember I was struggling for years to persuade my wife that I can have a beard, and then I decided, okay, you're not gonna decide, I'm gonna do it. And after I had it, I tried to trim it myself, and I didn't like it, so I shaved it off. And my wife was pretty fine. What have you done? Grow it back. My daughters couldn't recognize me. I said, no, you have to have a beard now. So I can't
grow it back immediately.
Well, it took me 3 months to get to the similar level, but it was at the very beginning. And it's not as easy, especially the first few months, but then it's okay.
Yeah, everyone says about the itchy stage, and it just, if you look after it, it's fine.
Well, it's funny, I only had that stage the first time I was growing it. The second time, I didn't have that. And so, I don't know. So maybe it's something to prevent the... It's for the preventing the young, you know, man to become a grown-up man. It's the itchy. If someone cannot do it, they cannot be the, you know, the manly man.
Yeah, well, I'd be worried to figure out what's actually under my beard if I got rid of it. I don't know whether there's even a chin anymore. Or just another beard.
Yeah, you can have a look underside, but then, you know, you'll be covered your eyes with your beard, and you cannot see through the mirror anyway. So.
That's my party trick. That doesn't work with these headphones, though. So,
I mean, I thought of doing like a Ming the Merciless, you know, kind of go full bulk, long goatee. There's a possibility for you.
Yeah, I mean, every now and then, you know, kind of friends and family all try and attack me with various things. And like at Christmas, I've got baubles and things that get put in, and LEDs and fairy lights and stuff. So far, I've avoided getting any glitter in it, because I think that's the only point where every, you know, I have to take layers of skin off to try and get rid of it. Never mind, get rid of the beard.
Yeah. Pressure washer, that'll do it. Actually, no, I mean, no glitter, it probably wouldn't. Yeah.
No, it wouldn't. No. You could use the pressure washer to keep the glitter people at bay, though.
Yeah, that might work.
I was looking to get a bandana for your beard. So sometimes when you do something that, you know, like eating or stuff, you can cover it. Or I know there is something, because I saw it in some restaurants. That, you know, porters or waiters, they wear it, something like that, but it's a net. I was thinking real bandana. And obviously there is something, but it's only in China, and I don't want to put, you know, Chinese fabric on my face, to be honest. Well, we all did the masks back in the day, but...
Yeah, so I got a beard mask from someone on Etsy. Okay. Who was doing masks for Sikhs. So it was specifically tailored for like people with big beards. Sikh gentlemen tend to grow the beards out. So it's got an actual pouch that you kind of stuff the beard into, and then it's a full mask with the nose piece and everything. But that was for a slightly shorter version of my beard. It would stick out the bottom and the sides now anyway.
Well, you can, you know, always fold it.
Yeah.
I wonder if that'd be useful for always like keeping the sawdust out of your beard in a workshop as well.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, the other thing is just to do the whole, you know,
yeah,
look at the t-shirt. I quite often do that if I'm eating something crumbly.
You know, when you have longer hair like Andy have, and then you have a hat or something, then you have that line where the hat ends in your hair.
Yep.
I had that with my beard and the face masks, because I used to work in a factory that we have to, for 8 hours, wear the masks every day. And I had a line over there, just the hair fold like that because of the mask. That's why I shaved it off as well. And then when I grew it, we didn't have the mask. It's more straight now. I couldn't get rid of it, even with anything, to be honest.
Yeah, it sort of curls into it then, doesn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah.
Sort of steam bending the beard hairs.
It's weird. Yeah, funny topic.
I just wish there was a good solution that wasn't stupidly expensive, because there are solutions, but they're stupidly expensive, for kind of good, sealable respirator. Because I find, even though I've got a short beard, if I'm doing something like spray painting, doesn't matter how tight I pull the straps on my half-mass respirator, I can still smell the stuff.
Michael Cthulhu, who does the big giant swords and stuff, he got one that's
got like a mouthpiece on, hasn't it?
Yeah, it's a nose clip, and then it's the mouthpiece that you seal with your lips, basically.
It's not very comfy.
Yeah,
not so much.
Yeah, I'm lucky enough to have that full face mask, but not the one that runs on the batteries. I have like an extension. I have to power it to the like extension air supply, and the normal air inlet from my compressor, it's too high pressure, so I can't use it, so but I managed to get like a small air compressor for airbrushing, and this is perfect for it, because it runs all the time, but it's really quiet and it gives you enough air, and there is a filters built in, so you can use it with the beard and stuff.
Nice.
I haven't used it in a while because I haven't turned in a while, but it's quite comfortable. I managed to get it from a friend, so that's not very expensive and good. Good solution for me. I think that people who invented the Grabo tool, you know, that basically it sticks to everything, you know, that vacuum thingy.
Yeah.
You know, there might be some, you know, some collaboration with masks and how to do it to be seal it, but then it's gonna, you know, suck all the air from you, so you have to work the other way around, but still seal.
Yeah,
so maybe like a double chamber or something.
A spacesuit, basically, is what you're describing.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Well, I have
Victorian diving helmets.
Yeah, I have the diving helmet, the full dive bell. The snorkel one. I have the like for snorkeling, and it's basically the full face. Well, you can see around everywhere.
Yeah.
And it's still double like a layer, because you have your face covered separately, and then all the rest you can see it. So you can breathe through the top, the fresh air when you're on top of the water. But then when you breathe out, it goes to the bottom, so it doesn't mix and it doesn't fog up. So there is, you know, something that probably be invented. There were people that were changing this to like a face mask in COVID as well. They built in filters on top.
Yeah, I remember that. Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's still, still the issue with sealing though, isn't it? That's the problem.
No, because it's quite big. Okay. So it goes, you can put the beard inside and it's seal around your neck. It's different than the one that we normally use. So not like only breathing. It's much bigger.
Mm. You end up with a big chafe. Thing stuck at the top of your head, don't you?
Yeah.
like a dodgem.
Yeah, it's quite clever because there is like a ball on top, and as soon as you dive, it just seals itself up, and you cannot breathe. So it's impossible to breathe water or something like that. And then we go up. I love it, especially in the sea. It's great for waves and stuff like that. And you can mount a camera on top as well. Got some footage from trips. I didn't post any.
You should.
Yeah.
Just for family.
Not something I've ever done snorkeling. It's something I fancy doing, but I'm not the strongest of swimmers. Although I am better when I have flippers on, because I did some less at about, oh crikey, be about 15 years ago. I had some swimming lessons, obviously adult swimming lessons, because I kind of wanted to sort of just for the exercise. And the class I was in, there were only about three of us. The instructor that was supposed to be there wasn't. So we had somebody else. We had this standing instructor for 6 months. And we were like, did a bit of an assessment and said, try some flippers. Because I tend to swim quite leg heavy. Mm. So yeah, legs are sort of going down, sort of dragging me down. So I'm kind of floating, kind of just below the surface, which is not great, really. Gave me some flippers, and the extra buoyancy you get from the flippers and the push up, you know, actually lifted me altogether in the water, and I was able to swim much better and faster. Then that was going well till the other instructor came back off sick leave and was just like, "Where you got flippers? No, put them away. I'm not having them." It's like, I lasted 2 weeks and gave up after that. It's like,
The correct teacher. And, you know, someone that knows what you need is also important. You never know.
Yeah.
I do miss swimming. It's been a while since I've been. I just quite enjoy it. It's difficult around here to go.
Yeah, I go for swimming, but I don't swim. I just go with my daughter because she's in a swimming club. So five days a week swimming.
Wow.
Yeah, mornings, afternoons, evenings. Yeah.
Yeah, swimming. It's competitive swimming. I've known a few people competitive swimming. They just like the schedule is crazy. Absolutely crazy.
Yeah. 6 a.m.
The best training is the actual kind of is swimming, isn't it? Yeah. It's not like you can supplement with that much other stuff.
Yeah. But she loves it, so.
This is good.
Yeah.
That's the important thing. If they like it, doesn't... I think it doesn't even matter. If a kid likes something, I don't think it even matters if they're not particularly good at it. Do you know what I mean?
No. Not just do it.
I think she's won a few things, hasn't she?
Sorry?
She's won a few medals.
Oh, yeah. 10 maybe already.
It's obviously good at it, but I think, yeah, sometimes people go, "Oh, you're no good at it, so stop." It's like, well, if you enjoy it, keep doing it. Yeah.
Yeah, the coaches always say, when you beat your personal best, that's the best you can do. You know, some people have better abilities, or they're stronger, or, you know, they swim longer, they have better technique. If you beat your best means that you're improving. That's all you need, to be honest.
Yeah, absolutely.
And keep doing what you're doing, because it means that you're doing something correctly. Yeah. So we are proud parents as well.
Rightly so.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think swimming's a good thing to help do. We made our kids learn to swim. They didn't particularly like swimming. Yeah, they're okay at it, but we kind of wanted them to have that ability to, oh, you've fallen in some water, you can actually get to the side without drowning, kind of ability. But as soon as we gave them the option to kind of find other things to do, once they reached a kind of a certain level, they both took that opportunity and kind of tried other things. Yeah, they did. They weren't. Neither of them were kind of natural swimmers. Neither of them were kind of particularly enjoyed it, but they were both proficiently able to get themselves kind of here. Yeah, then if they fell off a ferry in the middle of the channel, they're like anyone else, or like 99.9% of the population, they're not going to be able to swim back to shore. Mm. But if they fell off a pedalo in a boating lake that was too deep to walk in, then they would probably be able to get back to shore. Yeah, or if they just wanted to go swimming for fun or whatever, they'd be okay. Yeah, if somebody said, do you fancy having to go canoeing or surfing?
Mm.
Yeah, they'd be okay.
Yeah, like I'm old British Channel.
I'm more like I know how not to drown, so I know what to do to swim, but you know it's not great for me. But I'm quite a good. I have a good buoyancy, so I'm not gonna drown anyway. So I just lay down on my back, and it's
yeah. I was gonna say you and I both have that same bit of ease.
Great.
And just be able to keep breathing and stay calm. That'll generally do us.
Like normal people have to go to the Black Sea to have the same like we have in the swimming pool.
Yeah, I'm not. When I was learning to swim, which was an interesting experience at the time. Yeah, we had some psycho teachers when I was back in the day. I used to enjoy that they do things like want you to have a go at swimming the kind of width of the pool.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not talking sort of an Olympic size pool. Talking of a good size pool, but not an Olympic size pool. And I used to enjoy that kind of just being underwater. I used to be. Not so much now, but I used to be pretty good at kind of holding my breath and be able to kind of. I used to enjoy that kind of ability to be underneath the water and just sort of go, and used to be able to go fairly decent distance, probably the width of the pool, possibly even twice, but definitely one and a half. But on the surface, no, I just struggled to kind of get a breath on things. And then we had crazy things like when we had to learn in school, I had private lessons to start with and then went to school. And we had lessons in school. And in school, they went, you can't wear goggles because somebody'd been kicked in the face and kind of, had broken eye socket or something. It was like, and it was the days when it was almost like pure chlorine in the water. Yeah, so it come out, your eyes would be red. And at one point, the optician said to me, we'd been to the opticians after this, sort of, my eyes were so red and sore afterwards. He said, you got a choice. You can wear goggles, so that's not a choice. Or you can't, and you'll probably damage your eyes. Like, stop swimming after that for a very long time. So I was kind of 18, 19, kind of just going with friends and could put goggles on. Still quite like swimming underwater when I have, which is a while since
I really enjoy that underwater as well.
Me too.
Yeah.
You ever done any diving as like scuba?
Not me. I'm too buoyancy. I cannot dive. I'll have to have a lot of weight to pull me down, I think.
Put a ballast on, yeah.
Yeah, but I think if I go somewhere that there'll be a possibility, I want to try it because I really like underwater stuff, and that's why we have to have a fish tank as well. Interested in stuff like that, and it looks amazing, so I would like to try stuff like that, but maybe not, like we have a club here in the swimming pool that meet every few days, and they just go underwater in a swimming pool that it's 1.5 meter deep. It's not fun in that. If you want to dive, you have to go somewhere to see something as well,
Nice yeah, you gotta have. You gotta have. I mean, with the thing with scuba, you've gotta learn the.
Yeah, learn but
all the stuff. If you get it wrong.
But if you go, to the holiday, usually in places that offer diving, they have a 30-minute instruction. That's it. And you can go.
Yeah.
I've
worked with a few people who've been kind of dive. I just worked with one guy who was a dive master, I think it was. I couldn't keep up with the track with all the different qualifications he had. But yeah, it's just like, he'd come back from all these, back to the med and come back. And it's like, I'm a dive master now. It's just like, okay.
I think it all depends how deep you want to go as well. So the first level is basically for everyone, because the pressure doesn't change that much. I think that's the most
if you have to worry about deep pressure,
people want to dive without, you know, if you can dive with holding breath, that's, you don't need any instructions. But with the mask, I think you have to know how to breathe and stuff like that, because it's not pure air. I think it's some gas mixed with air.
If you go in just low, shallow depths, it's just compressed air. I did a try dive in the aquarium in Plymouth many years ago. There was, not amongst all the fish. They've got a glass sided swimming pool, quite small. It's probably only, how long would it be? About 5 meters long, maybe a bit more. About 4 meters wide. Right at the very, very top, in kind of, it's almost like a teaching room. And they can talk about, they have demonstrations of remote operated vehicles in there. So I did a thing in there, sort of, wife and kids were sort of sitting outside, actually sort of being able to watch. And there were three of us did it at the same time. And it was like half an hour. So they had a quick little thing, how to put your gear on. Yeah, it was a wetsuit, buoyancy aid, and it's a diving buoyancy aid, not just like a canoeing type buoyancy aid. So it was inflatable, so you can actually control your buoyancy and go up and down. And nice. Respirator goggles, they taught you how to clear your goggles if they got filled with water, and you had to practice that. Just fairly straightforward. And then basically it was about a quarter of an hour of just swimming around in this little pool, kind of going, I can breathe. I'm underwater and I can actually breathe. Because there's a little bit of the first time you go in, you get that kind of few seconds of, you just almost like you're holding your breath. And then it's like, I can actually breathe, and I'm not drowning right now. Because there's a moment, I experienced a momentary sense of panic of, I am underwater, I have got to breathe now, and I can. And that was kind of quite a relief. But it was quite a small space. So, one guy kicked me in the face with his flippers at one point, one of the other guys, because he wasn't paying attention to where he was. And obviously, didn't have much spatial awareness. So I basically avoided him. And they didn't give me... they don't give you a dive knife when you're just in a pool like that. It's kind of good.
Surely at that point, if he's in front of you enough to be able to kick you with the flippers, you actually needed a harpoon gun rather than a...
Yeah, it's more twisty turny. Yeah, I did. Have you ever seen what they do with the Navy SEALs, U.S. Navy SEALs? Not the animal SEALs. They're kind of the special forces guys. When they do their dive training, one of the things they do is they have them in a pool, and they've got various sort of tasks to do. They've got to clear their masks and. Then they'll get one of the instructors will dive down. The instructor will just be kind of free holding their breath. Will dive down. Will pull off their. They use the kind of system where it's a closed circuit system rather than an open circuit. So they're not sending out bubbles of air. So they've got a tube coming over both sides. So rather than kind of just one tube coming in to the mouthpiece, the mouthpiece still works the same way. It's in and out, but the exhaled air goes back into the system and gets cleaned of carbon dioxide. So it's recycling, so there's no bubbles. So they'll pull it off, and they'll tie it into a knot, and they've got the guys then have got to try and clear it. After these guys have sort of grabbed them, tied their tubes into a bit of a knot, tumbled them around a bit underwater, and then they've got to sort of clear it all. But I thought I would never have got away with it. I probably wouldn't have been able to actually do it, to be honest. Yeah, it's like, you just kick me in the face. I've got a sore face now from on the mask, but I'm going to tie your scuba gear up in knots.
endanger someone's life for a bit of a slap in the mush.
The water was only 2 or 3 meters deep. Yeah, he could have bounced to the top. The instructor there. I could have just said it was an accident.
So I just accidentally took his mask off, tied it in a knot, and flipped him upside down. Stranger accidents have happened.
It was some fish.
Yeah, plenty of fish. I mean, it could be more. I mean, they could have put this in the shark tank. That would have been more interesting, I think, though.
It certainly would have been.
But you got to get, I mean, once you start going deeper and you start getting into, there's quite a lot of physics in it and kind of, you know, particular compression and oil spill and what's happening to the gas and how long it lasts when you go deeper. And
stuff it does. I thought Boyle's Law was something about greasy food.
Hey.
Definitely don't build your own, submarine. It doesn't end well.
No, or if you do, at least get it, you know, peer reviewed and sensibly checked. And
I mean, that was a good lesson in not mixing kind of composite materials with
incompetent people.
Yeah, being careful with composite materials. That was a lesson and a half. I mean, can you imagine being the first person to come up with submarine or scuba gear and actually sort of going and trying it? I mean, the first sort of person, I've got this idea. What we're going to do, we're going to put this giant brass helmet on you and big heavy boots, which we're going to strap you in. We'll put you in a canvas suit to keep the water out. And we're going to lower you down on a rope to the bottom of the sea. And we're going to pump air down to you. So you're going to be fine. Don't worry about it. Just trust us. It'll be fine. It's just like, it doesn't get the depth wrong with the pump. Then quite. Look, they're not doing very well. They're tugging on the rope. They get them up quick because they kind of, they stopped tugging. It must be all right now.
It's like that with so many things, though, isn't it? You know, there's a meme doing the rounds on the internet of that with, you know, the first time someone decided to make horse glue. You know, it's like, tell you what, let's just take a horse, melt it down, and then see if it'll stick stuff together. You know? There's always, you know, someone with a really mad idea and someone daft enough to fund them.
Yeah. I think that like some of the other ones, like fish glue and rabbit hide glue, I think they were accidents. I think it's like, let's make some stew from this rabbit. Let's just throw everything in, We're really hungry, just throw it in. And got to a point, it was like, they're trying to eat it, and they go. A bit sticky there.
Chewing gum was, it was originally supposed, he was trying to make a substitute for rubber and accidentally invented chewing gum. And then he's putting really, really stupid flavors with it. Like tomato or carrot or things like that, and it was Wrigley, I think, was a mate of his, and he was doing washing powder, and he suggested putting mint with it, you know, completely out there, irrationally, you know, harebrained idea to add mint into this everlasting chewable sweet, and he wouldn't have it, so he ended up. Wrigley bought the idea off him and started giving them away free with his washing powder, to the point where he stopped making the washing powder.
Interesting.
You know, all because of an accident in attempting to make rubber that didn't need to be vulcanized.
Where was the accident in it getting into somebody's mouth first?
Exactly. Someone's mad idea to just...
starts chewing away at it.
Curiosity killed the cat and invented chewing gum.
You know, people are chewing everything, you know. You can chew an end of the pencil or pen or whatever.
Yeah.
Maybe it was a kid, you know. Children often put stuff in their mouth and stones and everything. True. You never know.
oh, look, my kid's been chewing that and he's not dead. Ooh.
That must be safe for everyone else.
I mean, yeah,
like Coca-Cola was a cough syrup at the beginning, I think, or something like that. Or just medicine for everything.
Yeah. Because there's some apocryphal stuff with that. Apparently it never actually used to have cocaine in it. It's just always been kind of...
There is a coke extract, but it doesn't have...
Yeah, that, I think that was what was in it.
Yeah.
I was going to say, I heard something a few months ago that suggested that Coca-Cola are the largest buyers of coca leaves, which obviously can be processed to use cocaine. But they still use them in order to get the flavor right, but obviously without the active ingredients. That
exactly, yeah.
I think now they work with the pharmaceutical. Yeah. But they use the pharmaceutical companies, they buy it to make the medicine, of course, because they use the coke for, you know, painkillers, strong ones.
Yeah, like and then the
stuff that they don't need, they sell to Coca-Cola, and they have like a cooperation going on. So it's a legal drug.
I heard a story recently about that with there was a Coca-Cola employee who'd left and he took the formula with him and he went to Pepsi to try and sell them the formula and they basically dubbed him straight into Coke. Kind of a, you know, solidarity kind of thing.
Which probably means they already know the recipe anyway.
Oh, yeah. I mean, this was a while back anyway. This was decades ago.
I always thought when I was little that Pepsi, Coca-Cola are the same company, just like, you know, the Coca-Cola is making Pepsi, just branded differently, so they sell twice as much because people going to have a choice.
I mean, give it another 20 years and it may well be. And it'll be owned by
but apparently it is
Nestle or...
Yeah, but apparently there was like a study that if you put only one, let's say a machine that you can buy Coca-Cola only, that it's going to sell, let's say, 100 cans a day. If you put only Pepsi, it's also going to sell 100 a day. But if you put both next to each other, you're going to sell 200 each. Because if you only one, the people get a choice if they're thirsty or not. But if they have two, they're going to think, oh, do I want Pepsi or Coca-Cola? They don't thinking if they're thirsty or not. They already decided that when they see it. And they're going to buy something and more people going to buy it. That's why there's usually the same stuff next to each other in the shops as well.
You gotta wonder about people. I mean, kind of going back slightly onto the accent thing, like the idea of the microwave came from the development from radar magnetrons. And supposedly the story goes that a guy was working on it and a Hershey bar in his pocket was melting when he was sort of doing an experiment. And you kind of got to think, the story is that he then went, oh, this is interesting. We can maybe use this to heat it. And within a couple of years, they developed a working microwave oven. And this is back in the 1940s. And so by the end of the 1940s, you could buy, and they were huge microwave ovens. And they were designed for kind of essentially commercial kitchens. You could get them for a home kitchen, yeah, but they were huge. The size of essentially a fridge freezer, a large, tall fridge freezer. And then over the course of the next kind of sort of 20 years or so, they reduced it down to the size of what we know now as a microwave oven. Yeah, something the size of a small box, I suppose, a small little cabinet that you could put your food in, you could heat it up. And particularly in the late 70s into the early 80s, they became really popular. People were developing foods for them. They became something that was achievable sort of price wise. They've stayed now fairly cheap for a long time. But yeah, the guy who sort of initially kind of thought that and kind of thought, oh, look, we can actually maybe use this for something else and started investigating that further. This is, why the hell wasn't he thinking, what am I doing to myself right now? It's melted the chocolate bar. That must be doing some damage to me. I'm going to stay clear away from this.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's that kind of element of, oh, this is, it's a scientific thinking. Yeah, I used to have a cartoon. When I was teaching, if I had my own regular classroom, and sometimes I'd do it in the prep room, depending on what I had, I would put up like scientific cartoons or cartoons with a scientific interest. And I used to have one. It was a picture of a guy, obviously in a white coat. He had a test tube and a beaker, and he was poured something into the beaker. And in the first panel, it was sort of three panels, and then the middle panel was kind of boom. And yeah, kind of, you could just see the sort of his hair standing on it. And then the third panel was him going, ooh, and basically trying it again. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's like, oh, it was an accident to start with, but oh, let's see if we can make it go bang again. I was just like, yeah.
Well, if he survived the first one,
yeah,
what worse can happen, you know?
That's the old, you know, skydiving's not for you. No, yeah. If at first you don't succeed, skydiving's not for you. It's that, you know, kind of what doesn't kill you can probably be used in anger for some other reason.
Yeah.
There's a couple of stories with that whole microwave thing, you know, whether it's the Hershey's bar or whether it's, you know, his lunch or.
Yeah. I heard the version with the ham and cheese sandwich and cheese melted. Yeah. Well, it was something. Maybe it was, you know, cold day and he didn't have a heating and suddenly he felt warm.
Yeah.
I mean, he just had to sit and turn around for a little bit, didn't he? That was the to warm himself up.
Well, no, he was only feeling Darwin heat in one place.
Yeah, Darwin Awards winner one year. For those who aren't familiar, Darwin Awards are awarded to people who remove their gene pool or remove themselves from the sort of the collective gene pool in stupid ways. So yeah, it's celebrated because they're removing their stupidity from kind of the gene pool, which may not necessarily be true. And yeah, it's maybe a bit of a strange way to look at it. And it's normally people who do daft things, like the guy who actually got awarded. And normally it's posthumous, but there was one guy who got it for attaching helium balloons to a deck chair with a crate of beer and an air pistol and flying over the airspace of Los Angeles airport now over the Pacific and had to be rescued from there. He didn't die but got awarded one. But there was a guy again, I think it was something like Midwest America, he was security guard at a power transmission plant which used microwaves to transmit power, and he discovered on the night shift that if he stood particularly on the cold nights, obviously in Midwest US, it can get really, really cold. But actually, if you stood in front of the sort of the dishes, it'd be warm. So one day, particularly cold, so he decided to get himself a chair and fell asleep in front of one of the dishes.
No,
and never did his round again.
I bet he didn't have a frostbite though.
Can you imagine the smell though? Yeah.
Crispy.
A bit like soup. It would have just been, you know, kind of a hot bowl of cold soup kind of thing. You know, it's that kind of warm on the inside, freezing on the outside, or the other way around.
I wonder if he blew up.
From my understanding, I have not read too far into it. My understanding was he basically just cooked enough to die.
Yeah, once you, because it's just exciting the water molecules, isn't it? So you reach a point where it would, your body just
enough of the right cells explode. Yeah, you just cook from the inside. Well, they say from the inside out, but in practice, there is actually kind of a surface effect. It's greater. You do.
Not very funny way to die.
No.
Yeah,
it's
great. It sounds funny, but
Yes, a CD. I don't recommend any of the following things I'm going to say to anyone if it's not your own microwave. You won't actually consume them. But yeah, it's like a CD put into a microwave. That's quite
CDs are good. Christmas lights.
Christmas lights.
Soap.
A light bulb, just an ordinary light bulb put into thing. Soap, yeah. Imperial leather. That works quite nicely. And that smells better than some of the other ones. A sharpener pencil at both ends. That's quite an interesting one.
Really, really big ripe tomato. If you cut it sort of through the middle horizontally, but not all the way through, so there's a little bit of skin still remaining. Separate the two halves, but so that they're still connected.
Yeah,
you'll see the sparks will jump between the two halves.
You can do the same with a grape, and you'll actually get a little ball of plasma over it.
Oh. Yeah.
The one I used to like doing, used to do this particularly with the sixth form, you can use a microwave oven to measure the speed of light.
Mm-hmm.
So you take something like, if you've got a rotating dish, you take the rotating dish out or turn it over, and then you put in another dish, non-metallic dish, and you've got three main choices. There are some other combinations, but three main choices you used to use. Either slices of sort of
cheese.
Those single slices of cheese, kind of Kraft, dairy Kraft cheese kind of slices.
Cheese in the inverted commas.
Yeah, the kind of plastic cheese, the sort of stuff you get on burgers. Marshmallows, mini ones work better if you want to take accurate measurements, and you cover the entire thing with marshmallows, just literally side by side, or chocolate. Be careful chocolate, because it does have a tendency to burn but not actually look like it's melted, so you have to kind of be a bit more careful. Run the microwave for a matter of seconds, and it depends which one of the foods you've got and how many seconds you use, so a little bit of practice with your own particular microwave, and that will give you then little patches of melted and non-melted food. You can measure that distance, and that's half a wavelength. And if you actually look on the back of the thing, it'll tell you the frequency. And if you know the frequency and the wavelength, you can calculate speed of light. And it's a pretty good experiment to do. And like the other ones, it doesn't mess up your oven to the point of you not being able to use it again.
Yes.
If you push, you can use butter as well. Just freeze it first to make it, you know, more firm. But I saw that experiment on I think one of the reels on Instagram. Someone was explaining it, so yeah, it works.
Yeah, it's a nice one. But yeah, of course you can always use your microwave to make a Lichtenberg burner.
I
saved one of the transformers from old to do it, but then I saw videos with accidents and decided, nah.
Yeah.
Now I've got a laser. I can design a fake one and just burn it. And no.
There are some ways of doing it safely. There are ways of having sort of cutouts, and if you have proper shrouding and things like that. Unfortunately, a lot of people don't. I did have somebody gave me a microwave transformer, which I was thinking of doing with it. To be honest, I took it to the scrap merchant when I did some scrap merchant trips a little while ago. So I basically figured at some point, like you say, I'll probably go the laser route, and it's just not worth the risk. I mean, I would put in sort of double cut out, double dead man switches, you know, so you got one for each hand. I would put in a screen, but there's still
the only way to vaguely do it even remotely safely is entirely remote.
Yeah.
And
I haven't got space for that. So
if you're actually actively involved in moving and touching that stuff, you need a slap.
Yeah. When I saw someone doing it, I saw someone on YouTube doing it. I said, "Oh, it's safe because you do it on the wooden table." But then they put that solution, you know, on top with water, and it was leaking down to the floor. I said, you just go take a bath and start, you know, drying your hair. It's the same thing. But
pretty much, yeah.
Basically, more dangerous is with the microwave.
Well, yeah, I'm pretty certain that is the most common killer of woodworkers. It's not the table saw X and stuff like that. It's people dicking about with those things.
But who invented those as well? You know, that probably was an accident as well.
Mm.
What were they doing?
Well, I'm not quite so sure whether that would have been accidental. I think more that would have been. I mean, how do we recreate
this lightning?
Well, I think
they were trying to check if there is electricity go through different materials, and they were checking, you know, what is the best. And they try wood, and dry wood didn't do anything. And then some solution come in, and it started sparkling. And oh, we can try that. You never know.
Yeah.
I bet it looked a bit more safe than what some people do, the nail and, you know, just holding the alligator clips while it is on as well.
I kind of wonder whether maybe it was. Have you ever seen, and I wouldn't Google it if you haven't, the effects of a lightning strike on a human body?
Mm-hmm.
No.
If you've ever seen the effects of a lightning strike in a human body, it is not dissimilar to Lichtenberg figures, fractal burning. It's not uncommon on kind of climbers, big wall climbers, in the Alps or kind of, Yosemite, places like that. If you get caught in a storm, it's not uncommon that you kind of get hit. Sometimes it's fatal, sometimes it's not, but the scars it leaves interesting. I wouldn't recommend Googling it if you are sort of sensitive to that injury and things like that. But yeah, it might be the sort of thing that somebody's gone, ooh, look, that person. I mean, obviously it's something that's only been possible in the last 70 years. So, somebody kind of going, oh, look, that electric shock thing, that electric shock, which obviously been possible for longer. I wonder whether we can reproduce that in wood. What do we need to do that?
Well, I mean, lightning strikes on trees would.
Well, yeah, it's true. Yeah.
So that would have been thousands of years.
Yeah. And in the ground. Yeah. You see it in the ground sometimes. Yeah.
They might not have had the same, thousand years ago, they might not have thought, oh, I wonder if I can recreate that with a futuristic microwave transformer and some idiocy. That might not have entered their head at that point. But
also, I think it's how they invented, figure out how to make glass as well. It was the lightning striking the beaches sun. And stuff.
Fire,
metals. I mean, if go back to kind of like the Bronze Age. Yeah,
how they figure it out to combine? I don't know.
Well, I think again, probably accidentally. The whole kind of thing. Yeah, copper was basically, and probably similar. You could probably find parallels to silver, tin, lead. We're building a fire. We use this bit of rock here, and it just happens to be an ore of whichever particular metal that has a melting point somewhere close to the temperature of the fire that you've set. Oh, look, something's pouring out of the rock. I wonder what this is. And then just kind of you play
the
with it.
The rock's changed. There's a problem.
Yeah.
they touched it. Oh, it's hot.
And of course, that would have been the time before warning stickers. So, yeah, that's the problem.
Yeah.
No label makers back in the Stone Age or the Bronze Age.
No one to sue as well.
There's a good whole food. I mean, the worst. I mean, think about it. The worst thing is actually sort of something like food, isn't it? It's like,
yeah.
Oh, there's these berries.
Yeah, Dave, eat this. Let's see you die.
We don't eat those berries because Uncle Nigel tried them and he died. And it wasn't just Uncle Nigel because he fed them to Cousin Jeffrey as well, and it's just like, they ate those berries, they died, so we don't eat those berries.
Yeah, so Ugg the grizzly is still alive, so just follow what he eats and you'll be fine.
Same with wild mushrooms.
Of course.
Yeah.
Yeah, because you've been foraging lately, haven't you?
Oh, yeah. It's, you know, in Poland, it's like a tradition. Everyone go with the families and to the forest and finding, you know, wild mushrooms. And you basically, from child, you are taught by your parents which are safe, which are not safe, and they're amazing. And over here, no one goes except of the just Eastern European people. And so the forests are full of shrooms everywhere.
I think there's a slight, you know, subset of Brits who do go for very specific mushrooms from the forests. But they don't get very far back out of the forest.
Yeah, I saw an episode with, I think, Jamie Oliver, and he was near Gloucester because he was here for the Gloucester pig, and he was cooking in the forest one of the meat, and he went to hunt for some mushrooms and stuff like that. And basically, he used something I never think I would use, something that grows on the bark as well. And he said, this is edible and really tasty. I never knew about that. Normally, I was taught whatever, you know, grow on the tree or on the bark or, you know, near, you know, like on the side of the roots, don't touch that. This is not, you don't know how to say if it's edible or not. But there is a general rule of if you look underneath the hut, I would say, if there are like a thin, like a, this gills? Is not safe.
It's like veins,
if it's like a sponge, if it's like a sponge, then it's safe. But you can then, you know, cut it in half and taste it. If it's, if you feel that it's like a really sour or like wine can be dry, really, really like this taste, then it's probably not good to eat. But if it's like a sweet, then it's fine. Yeah, some of it it's safe after cooking. Some of it are safe when you dry them. It's just in Poland, we have a saying that there are three books that killed the most people in humanity, which is Bible, Quran, and the Polish guide for mushroom picking. Yeah, because they're like, there are stuff that are highly poisonous that look almost exactly the same, like the ones that are really delicious. And if you're not really good,
that's
then...
the thing that always worries me. I mean, we used to do a little bit of foraging, not of mushrooms, we used to do some foraging when I was a kid. And yeah, we'd go, and like a lot of people do, you'd get things like blackberries, or the right time of year, we get kind of elderberries or elderflowers. And there's a variety of other things that you can kind of sort of harvest that are often found in hedgerows. Yeah. And we would do that as kids. And like, yeah, we'd get elderflower fritters, or our parents occasionally made kind of elderberry wine or the like. And there's kind of, for me, there was kind of, I struggle a bit with kind of plants and plant recognition. It's not something that comes naturally to me. There are some really obvious ones, and there's a lot that are just like, this could be that or it could be this, and if it's that, I'm okay. If it's this, then I'm done for, and I'm kind of a little bit nervous about it. Yeah, I'm not good with recognition. It's same with different, but the same. It's not going to be quite the same. Geology. When I do my teacher training, the place I went to, I went to Keele University for my teacher training. And that's the home of the Earth Science Study Unit. Basically, if you want to teach geology in this country, not there's many teachers of geology, but if you want to teach geology, that's the place to go to. And it was set up by a guy who'd worked for De Beers Diamond Place, made a fortune, then decided to go into teaching. And then kind of set up, after a few years of teaching, basically went into teacher training and then set up this place to study the sciences. And it was really interesting, really useful. And we had this multi-day trip, and we had a few sessions on geology, because back in, used to have to teach a bit of geology, less now. And we did this exercise this one time. We went to the local churchyard. There was a churchyard directly opposite the entrance to Kiel. And the real good thing about churchyards with geology is that, particularly if you're looking at gravestones, they have dates on them. So you can look at things like erosion over a few hundred years and actually see the elements of erosion, whether that's from kind of pollution or just natural erosion. And that will obviously vary depending on the type of rock. Some rocks don't get eroded very much, some do. Depends on the local weather, whether there's been acidic rain, etc., etc., etc. So it's really kind of good place to do it. And we would be paired up, the non-geologists would be paired up with a geologist, and kind of, you know, you'd have to go and identify stuff. And the geologists kind of, yeah, you know, they knew, oh yeah. They... And we had these like guides, and you kind of, right, okay, right, this clay, right. And you go through the guide, yeah, has it got grains or crystals? What are the sizes of them? You go through very sort of key sort of steps, yes and no's. And I go, that's limestone. And the geology student would go, no, that's a sandstone. Okay, right, go on to the next one. La, 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 similar sort of thing. Okay, this one's a sandstone. No, this is a particular type of limestone. I was like, throw the book in the air, just everything. Yeah, there's certain... Yeah,
perfect opportunity to just go, that's rock. That's rock as well.
Yeah, well, the trick is to stick to a particular area. Yeah, if you're on Dartmoor, 99% of the rock on Dartmoor is granite. Easy. Don't try and split. There's so many different types of granite. Just call it granite and you're okay. You're in South Wales. The majority of the rock around there, limestone. Nice and easy. Come down to the southeast of England. Yeah, there's an awful lot of... there's some, a little bit of limestone, but a little bit of sandstone, but there's loads of chalk. Yeah, if it's white, it's probably chalk. Yeah, you go up to kind of your parts of Yorkshire, there's limestone, and then there's, go to Derbyshire, there's more grit. it's like, keep it simple. But you know, the geologists, no, same with foragers. Like I would have a very limited diet if I was kind of just stuck in the middle of, like we were talking about alone last week. Yeah, if I was kind of stuck on alone in the UK somewhere, I'd probably be on quite a limited diet of plant stuff.
Or whatever had legs that you could catch.
Yeah. That would have to be. Yeah. There are some things I can recognize and I could eat. Yeah. Dandelion. Yeah. Dandelion's safe to eat.
Yeah.
Yeah. Dock is safe to eat. The kind of British plantain, which is different to plantain, the banana like thing. Yeah, that's safe to eat. Young hawthorn. In Wales, they call it barrack horse. Bread and cheese, because it tastes like nutty sort of cheese. That's okay, but you only want the young stuff, you don't want the old stuff. Similarly, nettles. Young nettles are fine. Yeah, older nettles might be all right in a tea, but that's about the limit for me. Yeah.
I mean, I can recognize a pear tree, but I wouldn't want to take a chance on an apple just in case it's a cooking apple.
Well, cooking, it's not going to kill you. Take a bite of a cooking apple, it's not going to kill you.
Oh, no, but it's unpleasant.
You know that when you play Conker's Whip, is that edible or not?
No.
No, because they're horse chestnuts.
That's a horse chestnut. That is not edible. But then there's sweet chestnuts, which are the one. So a horse chestnut has the very large, spiky case.
Yeah.
So they tend to be quite large, and they have fewer spines.
One seed.
A sweet chestnut. Sometimes there's a couple of seeds inside the sort of the conkers. Sometimes there's a couple. Generally, it's one. The sweet chestnut, they're still spiky, but there's hundreds of spikes on the case, and they tend to be a little bit smaller. But they do have to be cooked. You don't have them raw. They do have to be cooked, which is the, kind of the roasting chestnuts.
I saw a few videos lately, and someone was just roasting the one that looked like the ones that I know that it's not edible, and the big ones. And they just, so I have no idea now. always thought that the edible ones, they're smaller as well in different shape. I don't cook it.
Yeah, I mean, they can get quite large, but not as large as a conker generally. So there is an overlap with the size, but there is a slight difference in shape as well. So they do tend to come in pairs inside the case. So there'll be a much flatter side, whereas a conker will tend to be rounder. And we'll have kind of a lighter patch on one side, so you don't get the lighter patch, but you do get kind of a flat side where they've been together. And they're softer anyway, but they do need to be cooked. But it's the difference in the case. So a horse chestnut almost looks like a punk's hairdo, you know, lots of kind of individual spikes, but it's a countable number of spikes. Yeah, it's not kind of like five or something, but it's if you had one in your hand, they're quite sharp and hard spikes, but you would think, yes, I could count the number of those. If you had a sweet chestnut in your hand, they tend to be softer, they're not quite as hard, but it would be a significantly more difficult job to try and count them. The leaves of the tree is slightly different as well. So the horse chestnut has five quite large, so the leaf itself has five independent leaves on it.
Yeah.
I think just to point out there, Andy. Yeah. Go on, Carol.
I just want to say about the horse chestnut. I think encountered those in Poland, and we always built in school, a small animals, you know, with the matches and this and like an animal farm and stuff like that. Creative thing to use where it's around you or at school.
Nice. Now we in the UK, you end up drilling a hole through the middle of them, tying a piece of string on, and then just smacking the crap out of them.
Andy,
you started that thought process off with, I don't have very good recognition, and you've just given us an incredibly detailed.
Of enough things. Yeah, there are a small number. There are a small number of things that I can recognise and I'm okay with, but it's a very small number. It's like trees. I can recognise a hawthorn. I can recognise a horse chestnut. I can recognise an oak. I'm okay with you.
Thanks, mate.
Yeah.
Walnut.
But pretty much all other trees, something like a sycamore when it's in leaf, or something like a maple, because obviously they've got a distinctive shape leaf.
Oak.
But maples and aces, they're difficult to kind of differentiate. But if it's like an alder, an ash, or something like that, nope, I haven't got a chance. Elm, the rest.
Really?
Nope.
I think oak for me is the one the easiest to recognize.
They look like trees to me.
Distinctive. Yeah, oak's got a very distinctive leaf shape.
Leaves, yeah.
Some things I can recognize. Donna's just put in the chat, elder, rowan, and bramble. I mean, bramble, just because it's covered in, it's a spiky thing. And when obviously the blackberries come out, then that makes it easy. Mm. Same with elder. Yeah, elder's actually got quite a distinctive bark. We've got two elder trees in our garden. So, yeah, I know that's got a distinctive bark, as does silver birch.
Yeah.
Very, very distinctive. But,
it's a good point.
Like the rest, they're little things like that. But, if you put an elm, an ash, an alder in front of me, without a guide, I wouldn't be able to tell you which.
I'm just wondering if Donna actually meant the plants, or if it was just nicknames for the three of us.
Yeah, I'm guessing I'm the elder. Yeah. You two could fight over Rowan and Bramble.
All sounds good.
Yeah.
It is one of those sort of things. It's one of those things that, I've talked about before, but kind of, I've been into kind of bushcraft and that for a very, very long time, and I find that interesting, but I've never taken the time to really try and learn plants. And it is kind of one of those, people say you regret things you don't do rather than the things you do. As in kind of bushcrafting terms, that is a bit of a regret that I haven't spent more time learning some of those sort of things. Yeah,
well, that's stopping you now.
No, of course not. Well, apart from the fact that there's a million other things I want to try and do as well.
Ah, so you are the one stopping you now then.
Yeah, basically. Yeah. Yeah, I can tell the difference between an evergreen and a hardwood. Yeah. In winter, like also. Particularly. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was an amusing one, isn't it?
I started recognizing more trees when I started turning, because then I see, ooh, that will be nice blank.
It's all just future project on the ground.
Yeah, can I have a branch of this one and stuff like that, you know? Oh, you have some firewood. This would probably, when you leave it more, it's going to have nice stain from shrooms and stuff like that, you know? It's going to look nice after a while. Now it's going to burn. Well,
you mentioned turning just then. Have you been doing much turning recently? So we haven't really seen much from you.
No. A few years ago, I decided to do the full maintenance on my big lathe. I took it all apart. I cleaned it all. And it's still like that. I haven't put it back.
On the healing bench.
Yeah. No, well, it's all there. I know how to do it. It just needs some time and a very specific grease gun to put the grease back. I already bought two that's supposed to work, but it doesn't work. It's like it has the greasing nipples, and I've bought two universal ones with different ends, and neither works properly. And so I'm probably gonna have to replace all of them with different ones, but the problem is the new ones are screw in, and the one that I have there, they were pushed in, so I'll have to either weld it and then drill it and tap it, which is that's why it's still in pieces. Yeah, because what the point putting all back together without the grease? I cannot use it anyway, so it's just the tinkering. And since I get the laser, it's basically much quicker tool. I can design something, laser it within a few minutes or an hour, and it's done. Which is lathe was similar. I still got the small lathe, and I'm in the middle of setting up, so it's permanent. So my daughter can use it, I can use it. But it's mostly for like pens and stuff like that. But yeah, why not? Yeah, I decided to go back to
big lathe.
Sorry?
What make and model is your big lathe?
I don't know. It's Myford Maestro. It's quite old. It's Myford. I think the company still exists. I don't think they still make lathes, but they still provide.
I think more engineering lathes.
ML7 was the old one as well. That I know that mine was specifically a wood lathe, but there are some attachments that I can buy and turn it into a metal lathe because it's so precise as well.
Oh wow.
But it's more expensive, that tooling, than I paid for the lathe. So because I bought it second hand for like £200. So, you know. And it's big and heavy and sturdy. You cannot buy anything in that price. That will be probably the same. Yeah. I have a swivel head, so I can, and I have a ground standing tool rest. So basically, whichever the center point is from the ground, that big ball I can turn. But I only make one ball in my life, so probably not going to turn that big one straight away.
Yeah, definitely one to kind of work up to.
Yeah, but I already decided, so now I'm working only day shift, so I have more time in the evenings. So because of my shift work before, for 4 years, I haven't been going to the local wood turning club that I used to go every month. And now I can. So probably this Wednesday will be my first after 4 years that I'm going to go
and
enjoy. And it will be with, I think the demo will be with Colin Way from Axminster. He was on Central a few times as well.
Yeah.
Very, very good turner. And very entertaining as well.
Yeah. You never know. Somebody at the club might have access to a grease gun that will work for your the nipples you have. And
that's my goal. That's my goal, to go there and find someone that's gonna kick my ass to start turning again. you know, when you go and start talking with people that doing stuff, you know, all the time, and you start feeling it again.
Yeah.
So I like to be around people that are interested.
We can hold you accountable as well if you like. Yeah, we can.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, we can pass you.
No problem. I want to make another Christmas decoration this year on the lathe, because I already have a few on the Christmas tree, and I want to add some new ones.
Well, you got less than two months and two weeks. So, yeah.
Don't say things like that, Andy.
We'll check in every week to see if you've got your nipples greased or not. That's probably
I can still turn a Christmas decoration the small lathe, so it's not a problem.
True. Yeah, that is true.
And I suppose you don't have to have a Christmas decoration turned before Christmas, because there is always going to be another one.
Yeah, there'll be another one next year. Yeah.
Exactly. Well, we started making like a family tradition for like maybe 10 years now, that every year we add some new decoration that are handmade by some of us or all of us. And basically now almost all the decorations on our Christmas tree are handmade.
That's
by us, by our family. So some of them already, disintegrated over the years, and they have been replaced with something else. But yeah,
that's a wonderful tradition to have, though.
And you can see the tool progression as well. There were some first decoration I did. I think it was on the scroll saw. Then there was some lathe ones. Then was some laser edged ones and cut on the bandsaw, and then make on the drill and now laser, the 3D printed one as well. So wherever tool I have, I'm gonna use it.
I love that as a tradition.
Sounds like the sort of thing that really gets one's attention, I think.
Oh, smooth.
So bring us to the point where we kind of start drawing to an end to the main show, and we think about those things that have been sort of grabbing our attention, things that we kind of been working on or looking at or watching or working towards, or things we just finished, whether it's actually sort of making thing or just a book or a TV show, doesn't really matter. It's just going to those sort of things that have been grabbing our attention. So Carol, what, apart from kind of having to get back to the turning club and hopefully getting your big lathe back into one functioning piece, what's been grabbing your attention lately?
Yeah, basically the wood turning is on the agenda, but also I want to upgrade my laser to do round objects. I got like a turning table, but I have to figure it out, because my laser doesn't have a normal connection, so I can disconnect. So I have to rewire some stuff. So a bit of tinkerage on there to do. But I like that as well. So I like stuff to think about and make. But I also recently fall in love in playing board games. We started last year. And we have more and more board games. We try to play with the family when we have free evening. But I think I need more. So I found that basically a few hundred yards from me is a club that meets every week. And they play board games, and they get like hundreds of board games. And, just free for everyone. Just go show up and you can play with other people, other geeks.
Oh, nice.
So it will be Tuesday nights taken. So yeah, and I would love to start making YouTube videos. My daughters are pushing me to start posting some new videos. Maybe now I have more time. We'll see.
Got a little suggestion from Eric in the chat. For the rotary, you could add another stepper driver. Put a multiple rotary switch on. The step direct side, which is something they've done in their Megaspace laser. Oh,
that's smart.
That's something. Yeah, that's something I can look into it, because I was just thinking about, because there is like a normal wire going from the stepper motor to the stepper driver from the y-axis, and I just want to split it and make a plug and then unplug it when it's but something with the switch would be nice as well, but I'll have to unplug the rotary anything anyway, so
see. Something to switch between somehow, whether it is a switch or a unpluggy thing.
Quite a lot of lasers have a pluggy in thing, don't they?
But like you said, it's normally on the y-axis anyway, so
you basically change it. But I was thinking about adding one for the Z-axis, because at the moment I have a Hank crank to lower and raise
the
it.
Bed.
The bed. But I have some small motors, so maybe I can use it for a Z. I have a viability in the controller, so I can do it. I just need to upgrade it and add another motor. We'll see. So, all future projects.
Sounds fun.
Yeah.
Jamie, what about you? What's been grabbing your attention?
I've been doing a bit of chatting with GPT and a bit of planning over the weekend. I want to rejig some of my network at home to try and add a bit of security and a bit of fragmentation and, you know, kind of layer things out a little bit. So, yeah, just sort of playing with various large language models, nerding out with Duncan about it, and just throwing lots of information into the mix and then seeing what it comes out with. And delightfully, it's been really, really helpful in suggestions and then setup guides and, you know, I kind of gave it all the information of what I wanted to achieve and then listed out everything that was in my current network. And then it's given me configuration, like tutorials on how to make particular setups to refragment things and then set about setting firewall stuff appropriately. So, okay, then suggest me some firewall settings for each of the different fragmented layers of the network. And so then give me a big instruction list on, you know, what particular settings and then how to set each of those settings up in the pfSense router and stuff. So yeah, lots of fun nerding with large language AI models. Yeah, it's good fun.
Sounds good.
How about you, Andy?
Sounds good. I've got this now this week. I've been doing university open day visits. That's been this weekend, so a little bit tired from that. Got some more coming up as well later in the month. My dog's getting old, so I made a quick step so the dog can get onto the sofa a bit easier.
Aww.
We've just got to train the dog to actually use the step now rather than just sort of standing staring at the sofa, kind of going, I want to get up, but I can't. And not just doing it when there's treats available. Yeah. We've got a dog that's very keen on treats. And we'll do a lot of things quite easily if there's treats, and then take treats away. Not so keen on doing things. So that's been a bit of a thing. And getting into, I think I may have mentioned this last week, the repair cafe that recently started in my local town, which I was at, I got presented with some clocks to repair. And I was a bit kind of, yeah, I want to be able to do something with this. So I may have possibly purchased two broken clocks, one of which is a ROM, from a well-known online auction site. One has arrived. I haven't unpacked it yet. It's sort of sitting in the hall. So a couple of big kind of mantle clocks with kind of pendulums, hidden pendulums. So you can't see the pendulum, but there is a pendulum there in the back. One should be arriving tomorrow. One's already arrived, so yeah, over the course of the next few weeks, hopefully I'm going to try and get to understand a little bit more about not the complete ins and outs of clock repair, but enough to maybe get a clock working if it's not too badly broken and it's just a bit gunged up and needs a bit of a pendulum balance. So that's kind of sort of hope. Yeah. From what I can gather, there's a lot of kind of that's a broken clock is, there's just a pile of gunk built up on probably the inappropriate grease that's been put in there, and if you can get that off, put the appropriate stuff in there, and get things moving again, then balance the kind of pendulum, it'll probably be okay, and we'll keep reasonable time, and that's the kind of hope. So we shall see. I may just end up with a pile of stuff suitable for a steampunk decoration.
I was going to say, have you got the time to do all this?
Boom. Yeah. well, it's just what I want to turn my hand to, really.
I mean, it looks good on the face of it.
Yeah. I mean, it's a good way to wind down at the end of the day as well. If it's finding the right gear, that's just the other problem. I think on that time for,
before we lose the rest of our audience,
you can always make a video when you do it and post it on TikTok.
Boom. Carol, where can people find you if they want to kind of stalk you? Where can people find you best or easiest?
I think I'm most active on Instagram. Just look for KK Make, or search my name. You can find it by, I think, KK Make would be easier to pronounce and remember. I post my projects there and some stuff from daily life as well that grab my attention. And YouTube video is the same name, but on Instagram you can find all the links. So if I do some videos, you could probably have a notification on Instagram as well. So I'm gonna hope to do one this year. It will be a yearly video. And
it's 11 months since your last, which is less time than my last video, apparently. You can get the video up first.
Did that video because YouTube sent me a message that if I don't post any videos, they're going to take the monetization from my videos. So I did that video, I posted it, and they still take the monetization off.
Yeah, I don't have monetization, so not a worry for me at the moment.
I was almost a millionaire, 3p a video for 8 years. Great.
we can talk about that in the after show, which people can find by going to patreon.com/makerswaffle. So we're going to head over there now, and so we're going to say goodbye to the folks that are listening on YouTube and on the main show, and good night. We shall a little bit say hello to the after show patrons. So bye, folks.
Cheers, folks.
Hello.
Not there yet.